bottles. I want my money back.
Many thanks, said Arminius to the clerk. We may come back tomorrow and speak a little with you.
I look forward to that.
They left and returned to their boarding house.
I could not follow all that was said, said Dieter. What is a 40? Is he giving us important information about the surveying?
A 40 is a quarter of a quarter section, 40 acres, and he was certainly giving us important information, and, I believe, asking for a bribe. We might modify our trip a little. I would like to see that northern region.
I would also like to see it. Perhaps you will not always be a landlooker for Duke and Sons. Let us find some dinner in this rough place, and talk with the clerk again tomorrow, then set out to find those wondrous pines.
A day later they started their journey on two hired horses, one the yellow horse from Arminius's former trip.
At the junction we will bypass the trail to the Duke purchases and go north. Cousin, I mentioned that we will pass a stump farm that belongs to an incompetent farmer, Anton Heinrich. He has worn out two farms already and is quickly ruining the third. He has a quite pretty daughter. You have heard all the old stories about farmers' daughters? Yes, they are true. I lay with this girl, but it was rather... I can't say. Maybe we stop there again.
So Dieter discovered an unknown side of his cousin. Nor had he suspected he could speak so casually of bribes, for the clerk had made it clear when they returned the next day that information about the pines farther north should be rewarded. Arminius told him that if they found heavy timber to be there, they would certainly stop in on their return and make an arrangement. His cousin had become an American. The Heinrich log house came in sight. Mooney, one of the Dumkopf sons, was splitting stovewood, Kelmar, the other, stacking it on the listing porch. As they came nearer, Mooney slammed his axe into the chopping block and ran inside, calling, "Ma! Ma!" A woman with two small children clutching her skirts came out. Dieter thought she looked like a barn cat. She had been at her washtub, and her hands were like wet roots.
"Hello, Mistress Christina," said Arminius cheerfully. "Is Anton at home today?"
The woman gave a howl, threw her apron up over her face, and lurched inside. Arminius and Dieter looked at each other. Mooney edged closer and stood clenching and unclenching his hands.
"What is wrong? Where's your father? Anton, is he here?"
Arminius saw the daughter holding the hands of two more children. He stepped toward her, and she stepped back. Mooney opened his mouth to speak, as though he had something to tell, but didn't know how to go about it. Arminius looked at Kelmar.
"Was is los? Tell me."
He remembered the two fools had a few words of English, a few words of Deutsch.
"Vater,"
said Kelmar forcefully, and again,
"Vater." "Ja?" encouraged Arminius.
"Kaput,"
said Mooney. It was the girl who, keeping at a distance, told them a bizarre story. She looked only at Dieter and spoke to him in a low voice. If Arminius made a step in her direction, she moved back. She said the father had been chopping trees with Mooney and Kelmar. Father was not so quick. A big tree had fallen and pinned him to the ground. He cried for help. Mooney and Kelmar came to him. They were strong. They seized the butt end of the tree and began to pull. They dragged the entire tree across Vater's body as he shrieked. At this point, Mooney, who had been listening and grinning, gave an imitation of Vater's agonizing cries.
"And where is he now?" asked Arminius.
"He did not live. That tree's branches tore his belly and his inside came outside when they pulled."
"Kaput,"
said Mooney.
"Fucked," said Kelmar in clear English.
"Let us get away from this place,"
said Dieter sotto voce. He did not like Mooney and Kelmar, and it was clear the girl was avoiding Arminius. The whole family seemed deranged. The thought came to him that his cousin might be something of a scoundrel. So? They said nothing until dark fell and Arminius had a fire going. He said,
I have never heard anything as stupid as that. Never. They could have trimmed the limbs and lifted it off him. They could have chopped away the crown and butt to small size. One could have pried it up while the other pulled the man out. They could have rigged a hoist.
Dieter murmured, Sometimes one must get tired of chopping trees endlessly. For the next 10 days they walked through the great pines and Dieter became very quiet. Occasionally he scraped away the needles and examined the soil beneath the duff.
You see, said Arminius as they stood tiny and amazed in the kingdom of the pines.
I do, said Dieter, as though pledging a marriage vow.
A decanter of brandy stood on a side table in Edward Duke's mahogany office. Edward was turning the pages of a thick sheaf of survey pages and locating them on a crisp, new-drawn map of Saginaw Bay's shoreline with the Duke and Sons sections neatly crosshatched in sepia ink. He had come to believe the exploration and discovery had all come about at his urging.
Hello, Cyrus. Ready for the great move?
Cyrus would head up the new offices in Detroit. A wagon load of desks and chairs, boxes of papers, ink bottles, pens, and other impedimenta had headed west 2 weeks before, 3 fresh-hired clerks to oversee the journey and unpacking. A fourth clerk, Lavinia Duke, would remain at the Boston office and work for Edward, Free Grace, and James for a year arranging markets for their Michigan lumber. Edward had not been scandalized. Lavinia was blood kin. She was cleverer than any clerk Edward remembered. She brought order to chaos.
I have something you need to see, said Cyrus.
He unfurled another map, laid it over Edward's desk, and handed him a new wad of survey information. Edward stared at it without seeing anything remarkable.
What is this supposed to be? He said. It looks like land parcels farther north. Has James been enlarging the scope of the purchases? I do not feel we are ready to do this. We are quite overextended and need to see income before any more goes out.
He had finally noticed a name on the top survey page.
What is this? Graf Ernst August von Rothstein. A competitor?
Indeed. Look more closely. Edward peered. The purchaser of these northern timber lots was the RBB Timber Company.
Who are they? Maine men? How did they learn about this?
RBB stands for Rothstein, Breitsprecher, and Breitsprecher. Our old landlooker has become our formidable competitor. You may remember his cousin, the manager of an estate forest in Prussia.
Ichabod Crane. I remember him perfectly. Dreadful fellow.
The dreadful fellow is related to Graf Ernst August von Rothstein. He is enormously wealthy, and already their holdings almost equal ours.
I knew it. I knew it. I never trusted Breitsprecher. The snake. The damnable, cursed python.
It is too bad Lennart chose this time to be away. But I will go to James's house and let him know. Lavinia, behind the door, heard it all and ran home, getting to James before Cyrus arrived.
Papa! Treachery! She shouted. Breitsprecher and his cousin and a rich man have bought 250,000 acres of Michigan pine. They are now our enemies.
And so a rivalry began. 56. Lavinia. Edward. Fat, ancient Edward, who had become a great gourmand in the years since his wife Lydia's death, called for a dinner party to celebrate the rich returns of the first Michigan cut.
Everyone must come, though, of course, Cyrus and James cannot, for they are in Detroit. We'll have those hearty lobsters, though how they shall be prepared I will leave to the chef. Thrushes a la Liégeoise, and one of the black turkeys from Newport sweetened on acorns, la surprise, and then an English roast beef with Russian salad, and whatever else the chef wishes to give us. The wines I will discuss with Free Grace.
He laughed his old man's reedy, as Lavinia wrote out the invitations. It was a Duke and Sons business affair, and without doubt the company could afford to scrape the Boston market stalls empty, stalls always heaped with the bounteous harvests of market hunters at pennies for a brace. Pigeons, turkeys, wood thrushes and robins, pipits, countless ducks, swans and geese, even owls, reputed to taste like chicken. Lavinia begged off attendance. The thrushes were sure to be robins, and she could not bear to see them lying roasted on a platter.
"You know, Uncle Edward, that I cannot be in a house where cats live. My eyes swell and burn. I can barely breathe, and I get dizzy. It has been so since I was a child, and Mama allowed no cats in our house, for which I thank her."
"Oh, pish," said Edward. "Mrs. Train will put them out in the garden, and you will not be troubled."
It was useless to explain to him that cats did not need to be present. A house with cats was permeated with the invisible poison residue of their breath, their hairs.
"Do you not remember the last time I tried to dine at your house? How I fell ill and had to be carried home?"
It was an unpleasant memory, the gripping choke in her chest, the painful wheeze. But Edward said stiffly,
"I regret you do not show the same regard for cats that you exhibit for birds."
The conflagration spared four: two cats, the household cook, Mrs. Traim, and Chef Laliberte, who had been hired for the dinner. The scullions escaped early by chance and were sitting in the garden over a wooden platter of orts. In the half-cleaned kitchen, enjoying the leftover birds and a glass of steely hock with Chef Laliberte, Mrs. Traim heard a roaring in the adjacent dining room. She got up and opened the door. A sheet of flame leapt out, scorching her from hem to cap. The chef, no stranger to fire, seized her by the arm and rushed her outside, where they joined the servants. The opening of the kitchen door allowed a blast of oxygen to surge through the house, and they could hear the shrieks upstairs, where the dinner party had retired with the port and walnuts. A figure appeared in the upstairs window briefly. Mrs. Traim thought it was Lennart Vogel, then fell back into the rosy light. Afterward, when her injured throat allowed her to speak, she whispered she had twice chased the cats off the vacated dining room table that evening. She intended to clear it after she and Chef Laliberte had their own dinner and a restorative glass. She surmised the cats had knocked over the candle on the sideboard. They often romped on the furniture.
"When Mrs. Duke was alive, the cats were not permitted in the dining room," she said, and wept. "But after she passed on, Mr. Duke doted so on Casimir and Vaughn that he allowed anything, even letting them sleep on his bed, though it be well known that cats will suck your breath at night."
James Duke and Cyrus Hempstead left for Boston as soon as word of the fatal dinner party reached them. Edward and Freegrace had been very old, both into their 90s, but Posey and Leonard had been still in strong life. James, speaking slowly so as not to jostle his headache, found Lavinia in Posey's room sorting out her clothes, packing them into a great wicker hamper.
"Papa, I am so glad you have come," said Lavinia. "It has been dreadful, just dreadful. People call at all hours to express their regrets. Many think you were in the fire as well as Mama. I have had to repeat endlessly that you were away. I don't know what I would have done without Mrs. Traim."
"Poor, poor child. What a trial. And tell me what you intend with that clothing. Is any of use to you?"
He doubted this, as Posey had been stout and busty. His head pounded.
"The church ladies will send someone for the garments. They are to be distributed to the needy. I will keep Mama's jewelry and winter cloaks."
James thought that very few needy women would feel comfortable in Posey's silks, but what did he know? It might be a tonic for them. His hand fell on a kingfisher blue dressing gown Posey had often worn. Marabou feathers, fur muffs, satin slippers with tiny glass beads on the toes. He could imagine some slattern stuffing her horny feet into them.
"I saved out the crimson ball gown that she loved so well for her funeral dress.
James shuddered inwardly at the thought of his wife's charred corpse in red satin, but dredged up a painful smile for Lavinia.
You have a strength of character far beyond your years, and I salute you.
He needed to lie down with a cold compress on his forehead later. James breathed in and out gently, straightened up.
Come, dear daughter, let us go down to the library and make a list of what must be done.
We will have our plate of toast and decide on the future.
We must work together, you and I, to make a life.
He staggered a little with the force of the tightening vice.
Papa, are you all right?
Yes, yes, it's just one of my headaches. My grandmother Mercy was prone to headaches.
Shall I send for Dr. Cunningham?
No, I shall be well after a good night's sleep. How he longed for that deep draught of laudanum.
But as they entered the library, Lavinia said,
Papa, I think Mama's clothes are too fine to give to the poor. I have an idea I might sell them. Do I have your permission to try?
Sell them to whom? I agree that they are of too high quality to just give to those who will not appreciate their value, but who would buy them? I hope you do not think of approaching her friends on this.
He heard his voice meanly snappish.
No, I think I may go to a dressmaker's, Madame Aiglette in New York and Mrs. Braun in Boston. Both know her wardrobe. Indeed, many of the dresses originated with one or the other, and they have a select list of customers, some of whom may appreciate and purchase these beautiful garments. Mama kept them clean, protected from moths in the cedar closet, safe in drawers and chests away from the destroying sunlight. They are like new.
James, impressed by both his daughter's business acumen and her cool and unsentimental regard for the wardrobe, said she had his approval. He would have approved if she had said she wanted to boil cabbages. He wanted only to lie down.
I'll go to New York in a few days and speak with Madame Aiglette.
Dear Lavinia,
said the dressmaker, a tall woman with coiled black hair, her square face very heavily powdered.
I am sorry for your loss.
She allowed 10 or 12 seconds for grieving.
Your mother dressed very well in the most fashionable garments, and although this is a somewhat provocative situation, I think I can place a number of the dresses. One of my clients, married to a rising politician and of Mrs. Duke's size, perhaps an inch shorter, has many evening dinner demands. She is ever asking for dresses a little less expensive, and, of course, I never have such a thing. It takes time to construct an elaborate dress. This situation may answer the purpose very well. Now let me ask, what of her furs and capes? She had an exquisite yellow satin evening cape with glass bugles at the hem. Very desirable.
Mrs. Braun in Boston was even more eager to have the finery, the hats and gloves, boas, even the silk undergarments from Paris, and the least worn of the shoes. Some weeks later at the breakfast table, James read his paper while Lavinia opened her letters.
Papa, here is a bit of cheer which I badly need. It is from Mrs. Braun. We have cleared $2,000 on Mama's dresses. Should we invest it in Michigan Pinelands? It will gain us a few more sections.
For the 100th time, James thought that his daughter had an unusually canny eye for business. She was, always had been, a go-ahead type. If she had been a man, she would have been in the thick of every business fray, following the go-ahead method, accelerating, progressive. He remembered her childhood horse. Posey gave her a small amount of pocket money each week, but she had to earn it by taking instruction in sewing, cookery, music, piano. She had to make her own bed and run errands for Posey.
But the cook's boy can do that, and the housekeeper can make the bed, said spoiled Lavinia. Yes, but I want you to do it. If you know from experience what others must do to earn a living, you will be a better person with deeper knowledge of others. I have no use for the weak and helpless woman. You may need independence in your life, for women are too often taken advantage of.
No one knows this better than I. But when Lavinia pressed her for those details, she said, Never mind, you need not know. It is only that I do not want you to be helpless if your expectations are dashed. You will thank me someday.
One August morning that summer, young Lavinia had come to the breakfast table with a bulging red purse. She opened it and poured out $27 in coins.
I have saved this money from Mama's weekly gifts and my birthday gift. I wish to buy a horse.
James's eyes had flooded with tears of pride. He had looked at Posy and shaken his head in wonderment. Dear child, I will take you to the horse fair this coming Friday that you may see what manner of horse goes for $27. The Friday horse fair was not crowded at the early hour James and Lavinia arrived. They walked around examining horses, James naming good features, and warning Lavinia not to choose solely by the color of the coat or a bright eye.
We look for a strong, short back, a nice, muscled croup, straight legs, oh, 100 little things, and the teeth. It takes some years to know a good horse. It's like learning the ropes on a ship, and I warn you now that for your $27 you will not be able to afford a thoroughbred.
James suggested two animals, a gray Tennessee Walker with white on its face, and a handsome black 3-year-old Morgan mare. Lavinia loved both of them and could not decide. The owner of the Walker wanted $50 firm. The owner of the Morgan, Mr. Robinson, an elderly farmer with silvery whiskers and red apple cheeks, asked $35, but he winked at Lavinia, and they went over to the fence together to bargain, for James was determined not to step in. Lavinia rushed back, seized his hand.
Papa, she was born in Vermont. They call her Blackie, but I will call her Black Robin. We have an agreement. If we can go straight back home now and get Green Gage, my parakeet, and his cage and dishes, Mr. Robinson will take him in addition to the $27.
James could tell she put a high value on the man's name. The son of a robin could only be a good man, and, allied to birds by his name, he would be kind to Greengage, the most valuable parakeet in New England. Silently he thanked Posy for Lavinia's character. And now that Posy was dead and all her faults forgotten, he thanked the lucky day he fell into Boston Harbor. But all he said as Lavinia mounted her new mare was, "I doubt Greengage will enjoy the Vermont winters."
Mr. Robinson said he will live in the kitchen near the stove, and Mrs. Robinson will knit him a wool vest and leggings if it's a terrible cold winter.
Several weeks after the mass funeral, a letter of condolence reached them in Boston from Arminius Breitsprecher, with the postscript that if James and Cyrus needed aid, he and Dieter would be pleased to help in any way. Lavinia was inclined to think it presumptuous, but James took it in good heart, and said Duke and Sons were in no position to offend other timber companies.
We cannot tell what the future will bring. In fact, other timbermen are beginning to buy parcels of Michigan pinelands. Many of them are from Maine. Now, Lavinia, I think it is finally time to shift all our operations west, he said, dipping a crust in his cocoa.
Is there any decent society in Detroit, or is it still a captive of the wilderness?
Oh, Detroit is very well. It is not Boston, but it has a growing population and is convenient for our current business. We have a good, solid establishment there, and the lakes provide transport, though they are difficult and dangerous waters, quite as perilous as the oceans, yet not saline. One drowns more quickly, they say, but as for society, there is not much of that. It is, as you say, yet a captive of the wilderness.
Papa, have we a great deal of money?
The truth is that indeed we do have a great deal of money, despite the timberland purchases of recent years. Why do you ask? Is there some great expense you contemplate?
Yes. I would wish for this house,
she waved her arm over her head in a compassing sweep,
to be replicated in Detroit to the last roof slate. Perhaps it would be the first mansion in Detroit. Would it not be soothingly familiar if we had our old rooms? I can make lists of the linens, and Mrs. Traim may enumerate the kitchen goods, the plates in silver. We can order those.
James felt a frisson of fear. It would take many thousands to replicate Sedley's Boston house. But he could afford the expense. And what better way to use the money now coming in from the Michigan Pines? And there were the legacies from Edward and Freegrace, even from Lennart. He did not hesitate.
Yes, we can do this. I will contact an architect. We might even have a few embellishments added, as bathing tubs, bigger stables, and new equipages. A chapel dedicated to your mother. But I put my foot down on one thing. That monstrous mahogany hall stand will not come to Detroit.
We must have something where people can hang their hats and put their umbrellas.
We will get another, something elegant and simple rather than carved elks and hunting horns. For a week they talked of this new house. Mrs. Traim entered the sport with an eager list of improvements, a bigger pantry, a butler's room for cleaning silver, a larger staff that included two housemaids, a wine decanting room with a private staircase to the cellar, piped-in water instead of a kitchen cistern. But old Will Thing would have none of it.
No Detroit for me. I was born in Boston. I will stay in Boston. I worked all my life for your father and you right in this stable, and here I will stay.
But as soon as may be, we intend to sell it all, said James. You would have a new family in residence. Suppose you do not like them.
It is not my place to like or dislike. I shall get along, said the old fellow,
and there the conversation ended. James was disappointed and still hoped to prevail. Perhaps Will did not realize the horses were going to Detroit. Planning the new house became a postprandial exercise for Lavinia. After dinner, a stack of paper, sharp pencils, and samples of wallpaper littered the mahogany. James had years before chosen a hilltop site in Detroit with a sweeping view south to Lake St. Clair, that extra lake, too small to be great. He made a sketch for his daughter, outlining the back and sides of the lot as an encircling arm of forest opened to frame the bluest lake and distant smudgy Ontario.
This house will eclipse Black Swan, said Lavinia.
Oh, we will have no black swans, said James. In any case, let us leave the water feature to the landscape designer, whom we must still discover.
We might send to England, where these fellows abound.
This country is too young to have acquired such glossy professions. It will take several years to construct this house as we wish, so we must put up with something simpler now. The company houses I had built 2 years past will do.
He felt his headache creeping in, a tiny pain in his neck that would, he knew, grow into a throbbing agony. He resolved to find another doctor who might help him. But if this was the amusement of evenings, for Lavinia the daytimes were packed with study and reading of newspapers and government bulletins that came in the mail coach, writing letters and quizzing visitors for news of new inventions and technical advances. Most of the news concerned the exploratory claims of various would-be railroad promoters. Short local lines were springing up all over the eastern cities like weeds after rain, and there was no doubt that a transcontinental railroad would be built sooner or later, but the fights over the central northern route or the southern route were ferocious. Both James and Lavinia were in favor of a northern route.
It will be another 20 years before they lay the first rail, said James.
His thoughts were on another invention.
Have you read anything of the telegraph experiments? No? They say the electric telegraph will allow people to send messages over great distances as long as there is a copper wire to carry the impulses. Imagine!
If the process comes to pass, and if the wire comes to Detroit, I can send an immediate message to someone in Boston, a message that can be read within minutes. But so far it is only on trial in England.
Lavinia was charmed by the idea of words traveling along coppery wires like ducks swimming across a river inlet. It seemed close to a fictional tale. James lit his cigar and puffed, immediately put it out as it urged the headache to reappear, then said, What do you think of a rotunda with a stained glass ceiling for the entrance? But his heart wasn't in rotunda discussions. A new doctor, a neurologist, was coming at 8 with a curative contraption. James, wearing Putnam's head electrode on his cranium and hoping static electricity would finally overcome his headaches, was overwhelmed with work. The design of the new house caught only fitfully at his imagination. With the loss of Lennart to the work of handling jobbers, the new hired landlookers and scalers, their lumber volume reports, the lumber camps and their expected yield, the actual yield, their sawmills and the requests for new equipment, as well as technological developments in milling, commissioning shipyards to build lumber barges to deliver the milled lumber to brokers in Albany, all fell on him. Nor could Cyrus do Lennart's work, as he was busy with the complex order department. He personally knew every naval buyer, every lumber dealer. No, Cyrus could not take on Lennart's work, and no one could replace that head full of company history and lumber knowledge. But someone could try. "Lavinia," he called, "will you come here a moment?" He explained that someone had to handle the details of the current production work. They could hire an outsider, and likely would in time, but immediate attention was vital. If she could temporarily take on some of Lennart's work, well, not the exploration, but the day-to-day affairs. He knew it would be very difficult for her. She was only a woman, and there would be resistance to her from every logging contractor. Duke and Sons had 2 jobbers at work in Michigan now, both more than a day's ride from Detroit. 5 more applying for winter work had to be interviewed. Lennart had been able to saunter into a camp, eat pork and beans, josh with the men, discover how the cut was going. But James would not ask Lavinia to go to the individual camps. Instead, he would request the jobbers to come to Detroit and make a report to her.
"Why should I not go?" she said.
"Because you are a girl, a woman. It isn't done. It's impossible."
"Papa, it is not impossible. It is not customary, perhaps, but I will make it so. I insist. If I do not know the jobbers and see how the camps operate, there is no way I can judge their worth, or the cut. You and Lennart told me I am doing well learning the business. This is a necessary step. If I could, I would hire on to cut trees, the better to know the work. I will visit the camps, starting as soon as we can get ourselves removed to Detroit."
"Lavinia, this is only temporary. I am searching for a permanent replacement for Lennart." It was time to go. 16 wagons of household goods and linens had been crated and shipped. Lavinia leaned far out of the coach, looking at her childhood home. "I go into a new life," she thought. "I will succeed." In Detroit, Cyrus and his wife Clara welcomed them with a heavy pork and potatoes family dinner. Clara's pride was the elaborate dining room chandelier with 1,000 crystal prisms. James ate little. He had come down with intermittent fever on the journey and, after the roast pork dinner, took to his bed for 5 days. Clara and Lavinia instinctively disliked each other. Clara, from an important Boston family, Judge Spottiswood was her father, was the ideal woman with a simpering way, averted gaze, and subservient fealty to Cyrus, who sprawled about in a lordly manner. She was known for her collection of silk scarves and shawls. The children were automatons, chirping "yes, mama," "yes, papa," curtsying, and very quiet. After dinner, the company had to go to the music room and endure an hour on narrow chairs while Clara played the parlor organ and entertained them with mournful songs of lost dear ones. Duke and Sons' 3 company houses in Detroit were a great step down from the Black Swan estate. Cyrus and his family had the center house, with 2 wind-whipped rose bushes in the front yard. They called it Rose Cottage. James, with a manservant and cook, settled in the one to the east. Lavinia had the west house, which she thought extremely rustic. But the rooms on the 2nd floor had a view of the lake and its marine traffic.
I shall learn every ship, she said. I shall get a spyglass and study them.
On the ground floor there were servants' rooms, kitchen, dining room, and parlor. The Boston housemaid, Ruby Smythe, rather sniffy about the situation, had one room, and Mrs. Traim settled into the other and her new kitchen with a bare minimum of cookery equipment. She had no complaints with the great cast-iron stove, its hot water reservoir, and the brimming wood box filled every morning by Robert Kneebone, an all-purpose Duke employee. The plan was to live very simply for several years until the new mansion was ready. It was only the promise of the great new house that kept the snobbish maid in service. James had found a New York architect, Lyford L. Lundy, who studied Black Swan until he knew every feature to be replicated in the Detroit house. He had ideas for improvements and set them out in letters that arrived daily and irked James. "We must get the business established here," said James, "and let Mr. Lundy and his assistants deal with the new house. I have given him all the suggestions we discussed, which he is to work into the design. Let him do it. He has carte blanche with the money and as much fine Michigan pine from our Arrow Mill as he can use." As soon as he thought of the mill, James decided a tour would instruct Lavinia. "Tomorrow, I'll take you to our sawmills. You must understand every part of the business, and the mills are at the heart of it. Arrow Mill, the closest, is not as I would wish. We have ordered new saws and equipment." To Lavinia, the mill seemed a wandering ramshackle affair spread over acres of yard with narrow passages between stacks of drying lumber. The mill was on a good stream, and the dammed pond produced enough power to run an overshot wheel and two heavy up-and-down saws in the same frame. But the place was silent when they arrived, and a boy came out and said his father was picking up a replacement saw from a shipper near the wharf.
"The old one bust out most the teeth."
"Then let us go on and look at the other mill," said James. The Push Mill, called after its foreman, Joe Bushard, sawyer and millwright, better known as Joe Push, lay a mile upstream. When Lavinia stepped through the doorway into the roar, Push shut off the saws, a single muley saw and a two-blade gang. He came bustling up to James, looking at Lavinia from the corner of his eye.
"Mr. Duke, I never know you was coming."
"That's how it is, Joe. Surprises now and then. I'm taking my daughter around to see the parts of our operation. Go ahead, turn him back on. She wants to become acquainted with milling. She has a position in the company." The millman threw the lever, and with a wet clatter, water dumped onto the wheel outside, and the muley saw began to gnaw slowly through the log with a steely nasal sound. A rain of sawdust fell below, the air thickened with the smell of pine, earth, and hot metal. Lavinia saw how the log carriage was pulled forward by a cable, and at the end of the log, another small wheel gigged the carriage back. Two edger men put the fresh-cut boards on top of the log, Joe Push reset for the next cut, and the saws began to bite again, removing the bark edges from the passenger planks. Men carried them outside to a stack. The pond man sent another log up the ramp.
"Slow, but she gets it done,"
Joe Push said, pointing to the great ziggurats of boards outside, temples of wood boards. They walked about in the noise and dust, watching the men in the mill pond harry the logs to the bottom of the ramp. In the yard, a dozen men were bucksawing small and crooked logs into firewood chunks, stacking them in drying sheds.
"A nice bit of extra income from waste wood," said James. He pointed to a mountainous stack, said, "Lavinia, note the bottom front crosspiece. It ensures the pile slopes and allows rain and snow to run off. There's an art to building a proper pile."
"How long does it dry?"
The stacker spoke up.
"For this year, Pine? Say a year for your one-inch boards. Better 2-3 years or more for thick stuff."
"Yes," said James. "Of course, we want to get it onto the market as soon as we can, so drying sheds such as the men here are using for firewood are helpful to get your market lumber ready sooner rather than later. One of our problems with drying lumber on site is that when the cut is finished and the men move to another area, the mill is usually dismantled and transported as well. Lumber thieves come and help themselves to untended drying stacks, So we usually hire one of the shanty boys, an injured or older man not as strong as he was, to stay behind until we move the lumber ourselves. The stacker grunted.
This is why some timbermen, not I, say it is better to move the logs to a permanent mill that is always guarded.
They walked to the back of the mill, and Lavinia glanced at a pile of something, shrieked, and put her hands over her eyes.
Great gods! Mr. Bushard, come out here and explain this horror, shouted James.
Joe Push hurried out, not knowing what they had found, a corpse or a ruined board, and then laughed.
That's all them snakes the boys got last week. Had a big parade of frogs, and every snake for 10 miles around showed up to eat on them.
There were thousands of huge, muscular snakes in a 6-foot pile, now beginning to rot and give off a memorable stench.
Better pitch them into the river, Joe, or you'll have a dozen bears on your hands. Already shot 2, but sure, we'll give him the heave-ho.
On the way back, Lavinia asked James why they did not have circular saws in the mill.
I have read or heard that circular saws cut much more quickly, as they are continuous and do not have to be reset.
Why, you are quite right, and we have them on order. But it is not so easy to do everything at once.
This mill was already in operation, and we bought it from Joe Push, whom we now employ. There will soon be hundreds of sawmills in the Michigan woods if it is anything like Maine. This old gang rig will be sold and replaced with circular blades as soon as they arrive. I would like to put turbines in place for the extra power and really cut some wood. This rig can only produce about 3,000 board feet a day right now, and the shanty boys cut trees so fast the mill can't keep up. The weak link in the chain is the milling. I want to put a portable mill at every cut where it is convenient and transport lumber, not just logs. There is no reason why the mills cannot follow the lumber camps, cutting on site as we go. But a permanent mill near a town or city has several advantages beyond foiling thieves. Lennart and I once discussed someday adding a finishing mill to our operations that could sand planks smooth, and even a wood steaming oven to form stair balusters and such. Cyrus objected strongly to Lavinia's plan to visit the lumber camps, and when she persisted in writing to the jobbers, Hobble Peterson and Vernon Roby, announcing her coming inspection, he said that although he was terrible busy, he would put his work aside and go with her as her protector.
You cannot go alone, he said. You are too young and too womanly beauteous. You simply cannot go alone.
Lavinia blushed scarlet.
Uncle Cyrus, I am no such thing, and I will go. I will ride Black Robin. She will see me through safely. I know I can do this.
But James agreed with Cyrus.
It is not just the trails. There are roughnecks in the woods everywhere. There are men who would harm you. Renegades and low fellows, as well as stray Indians. You must have someone, a man, with you. You must. I mean it, Lavinia. It may be different when you are older, but now it is not. No argument. The travel is arduous. You do not know the way. You cannot build a fire in the wilderness. You cannot defend yourself against wild beasts or human beasts. Cyrus is needed here, so I will find a steady, woods-wise man to go with you.
He inquired of the Detroit hostler Paul Roque about a suitable travel companion and protector. On the next afternoon, Roque suggested his oldest son, Andre Roque, a competent hunter who knew the ways of the forest and who had worked in both of the camps. Lavinia proposed to visit. He could speak French and some Indian. James met the young man, taller than his father, very bashful and shy. But he answered all of James's questions easily. Yes, the best way to make this journey was on horseback. His father, the hostler, could provide the best horses in the stable. They were used to the forest trails, and so would be better than a Boston horse, however highly esteemed. He would cook all their food and serve it, groom and feed the horses, prepare the bedrolls and blankets, point out whatever local landmarks they passed. He would protect Lavinia with his life. He would do his best. It was early October, and the first inches of snow lay in the cold woods. The horses' breath, their own breath, steamed. The endless procession of huge trees aroused a new sensation in Lavinia, a powerful sense of ownership. They were her trees. She could cause these giants to fall and be devoured by the saws. She regarded their monolithic forms with scorn. Her trees, well, her trees with James and Cyrus. And the birds that rested in them. Her birds. Her squirrels and porcupines. All of it. At the end of the day, Andre built a lean-to shelter with the fire in front of it, their separate blankets at each end, and the impedimenta and saddles stacked between them. She was asleep before he finished rubbing the legs of the horses. But she woke in the night to feel the youth embracing her from behind, his breath on her nape, one hand over her left breast.
"What are you doing?" she said fiercely.
Andre Roque was silent, breathing slowly and regularly. Stiff with outrage, she lay still and gradually realized that he was asleep, not plotting rape, but deeply asleep. Did he fancy he was protecting her? Or was this how he slept with all his siblings in the home bed? She would explain in the morning that proper people of opposite sexes did not lie together unless they were married, and fell asleep herself. In the morning, Andre was some distance away making a fire, fetching water for tea, cutting hunks of bread from the loaf, feeding the horses. He seemed his shy, quiet self and handed her a cup of hot black pekoe. He said nothing about his presence under her blanket, and although she opened her mouth to begin, somehow she said nothing. The most troubling part of the experience was the depth of his sleep. When she spoke, he should have awakened. Suppose hostiles or predatory beasts had been creeping toward them. He would have slept blissfully on while wolves gnawed her arm. And what if the fire had gone out in the small hours? Such a deep sleeper as he could not replenish it. Perhaps he was even feigning sleep. These possibilities were marks against him. Still, in a few nights, it seemed quite the ordinary way to sleep, and she was glad of his warmth and closeness when branches cracked in the darkness and the owl called, and he was always up and at work by dawn. They reached Vernon Roby's camp in mid-morning, the sun very bright in a cloudless sky, the river so brilliantly reflective the sun glint was painful. They came into a clearing surrounded by forest except along the shore, a landscape of stumps as far as Lavinia could see. There was no one around. They went to a shack with a sign saying "Office" over the door. It was empty. "Heyo," called Andre, and got a jay's call for answer. There was smoke coming out of a stovepipe from a log building. A door was ajar, and Lavinia pushed in. A man slinging tin plates along an endless table was making such a clatter he did not hear her speak. She tried again.
"Sir! Sir!"
He turned and saw them, gave a high shriek, and dropped the armful of plates. Lavinia rushed to help pick them up, but the man motioned her away.
"What you want? Who you are?"
"I want to see Mr. Roby. I am Lavinia Duke, and I sent him a letter telling him I was coming to look at the cut."
"Oh, Christ! He's out with the boys."
He gestured at the stumps.
"About 2 miles up the lake. Jesus Christ, he don't know you coming here."
"I wrote a letter."
"He don't read. He don't get no letter."
Lavinia was annoyed. This was a charade. "Please go and fetch him. Right now."
"Can't. I'm cook. Soon they come eat. Be mad if it ain't on table."
"Go now. Now, or I will fire you from your job."
The unfortunate man went out.
"We might as well sit while we wait," said Lavinia to Andre. "Perhaps I had better see what he is cooking."
It was a great pot of stew. Biscuits rising, but not quite ready to go in the oven, stood on a table half covered with a forest of sauce bottles. Lavinia, unable to sit and wait, stirred the stew, just beginning to catch to the bottom of the pot. She put a few sticks in the fire and opened the oven door to gauge the temperature. Hot enough for biscuits. They waited. The biscuits rose. Lavinia put the pan in the oven and noted the time on her little watch. Just as she was taking out the browned biscuits, the cook came rushing in, his chest heaving with anxiety. He saw the hot biscuits, turned to the stew, which Lavinia had pushed to the back of the stove, where the heat was less. "I stirred it," she said.
"Okay, okay. Good."
Vern Roby came in a few minutes later. He was a short, heavy-set man with an eye patch and thin scars on his face. He said nothing, just stared at her, then turned to Andre.
"What's she doing here?"
"Mr. Duke sent her. She's his daughter. She come to see you. Look over the cut."
"A woman? This ain't woman's business."
He turned to Lavinia.
"You better pack up your kit, miss, and skedaddle. Where's Mr. Vogel? Leonard Vogel, he's the one we work with for Duke."
"I sent you a letter, Mr. Roby, explaining that my uncle Leonard Vogel died in a fire last year. I am assuming some of his duties. Knowing the men cutting for Duke and Sons is one of those duties. This gentleman is Mr. Andre Roque, who is accompanying me. Uncle Leonard is gone, and whatever you may think of the arrangement, I am taking his place. You may find me ignorant at first, but I hope we will get to know one another and be able to speak frankly and honestly. Perhaps you will tell me the situation. It looks like an extensive cut. I would like to see the landings and hear your plan for the spring drive. I would like to hear of any problems you have or anticipate, problems of any kind whatsoever. I am not here to interfere, but to see what we may expect in the spring. Precisely what Uncle Leonard would wish to know from you. And I have the authority to fire or retain you, according to what I may find."
Roby took a deep breath. "Another?"
"Yes, ma'am," he said, standing like a trained bear.
He looked at Andre, tried to regain his command.
"I remember you. Worked horses for me last year, yeah?"
"Yeah," said Andre in an insolent tone. No help for Roby there. She wanted to see the choppers at work. Roby shook his head in disapproval, but they walked along the edge of the icy skid road to a hillside where men chopped and the echoes flew back at them. A tree fell. Axemen went at it, slashing the limbs, severing the top. The men glanced covertly at Lavinia. Hot breath puffed from their mouths. The air tingled with pine. The men hitched a chain around the log butt and jockeyed it onto a sled. Someone's foot slid. She heard a muffled curse. Out of the corner of his mouth, a man wearing a red toque said to his fellows,
"See that woman? That's the rich man's daughter of privilege there, come to see the working stiffs like a zoo. Old Duke owns everything, you see. He got it free from the government, the big giveaway, stealing public forest land, cut it down and get rich."
"Save it for later."
"Don't you worry, I will. Tell you how they get the power and legal rights, fix the laws, them taking everything got value, trees, copper, everything for themselves. Working man don't get nothing but older."
Lavinia did not hear what he said, but after her year in the English girls' school, she was sensitive to the most subtle of oblique sneers, the hunched shoulder and lifted chin, and she felt his antipathy. Two could play at this game, she thought, and looked often in his direction, always finding his hard little eyes.
"One more question, Mr. Roby. Who is the man, the chopper in the red toque?"
He knew instantly who she meant.
"Heh, Rattle is what he calls himself."
"I would like you to dismiss him."
"Miss Duke, he is a bit of a talker, but a good axeman."
"Dismiss him, Mr. Roby. Today."
Horses drew the logs from the cut to a landing where Lavinia was startled to see a young woman, younger than she, a girl, come forward with a branding hammer and strike the D&S mark into the end of the log.
"That girl?" she asked Mr. Roby.
"That's Angelique, the cook's daughter."
"Is he not concerned for her safety among so many rough men?"
Vernon Roby laughed for the first time that day, a great, roaring, hearty laugh.
"No, she got seven brothers chopping here, see? Him over there, that one."
He pointed.
Nobody bother her, they want to live. She most strong as a man anyway. She got that hammer. She break his arm.
That was something new to think about as she made counts of the number and sizes of the logs. Lavinia determined to learn scaling. It was useless to say that you had 500 logs with an average diameter of 37 inches. How many feet of inch-thick boards would come out of that log? How did you allow for the bark, for the saw kerf, for the taper of the log? She wanted to learn the mathematics of scaling. She knew there were log rules that took all of these variances into account and let the scaler make at least an estimate of the number of boards in a single tree. How to learn the skill? She wished that Breitsprecher still worked for them. He had been a good scaler. Once, Lennart had spoken of a minister turned schoolmaster at a female seminary somewhere in Ohio who was working out a detailed mathematical guide to estimate board feet in standing trees. One thing she knew from life was that nothing could be known precisely. No one could make a perfect rule to accommodate every tree. No one could know when a cat would knock over a candle. She had determined as a young child on her way to England not to be taken aback by the most untoward events. She might arrange a visit to that minister and beg him to show her the art of scaling, though a ladies' seminary seemed far from the right place for such instruction. But perhaps not. And because of Angelique and her hammer, Lavinia entertained an image of an army of young women advancing into the forests with their scale sticks. In the afternoon, the light beginning to draw in like the neck of a sack, they left Vern Roby. Lavinia shook his hand, promised, threatened, to come again in the spring for the drive, the log drive, her logs running to the mill. Roby caught her casual expressions of ownership. He knew which side was up, smiled, said he would look for her in the spring. As they disappeared into the trees, he beckoned to the man in the red toque. He did not know how Lavinia had picked the one troublemaker in the crew, but she was right. Somehow she could judge men. Rattle constantly stirred the boys up for higher wages, better hours, special food.
"You, Rattle," he called. "Pack your turkey and hit the road. Here's your time. The lady don't like your looks."
The visit to the Hobble Peterson camp did not go as well. Peterson disliked women, whom he considered brainless and backward, refused to talk to her, and addressed sarcastic replies to her questions only to André Roque. His camp was dirty, the ground littered with wood chips, torn rags, a ragged oxhide, several broken barrels surrounded by circling flies, broken axe handles, rusted wire and worn-out saw blades, discarded boots. The drying lumber stacks looked ragged, and the ends sagged. As they rode away from the camp, André, who had been silent until now, followed her glance and said, "Them boards won't dry even." Lavinia noted all of this in her little red book, a book that became infamous in the logging camps, for a bad report from Lavinia meant the jobber would not work for Duke and Sons again, as Peterson discovered when the spring drive ended. On the return trip, there was one night when André was thoroughly awake. A storm had been hovering on the horizon all afternoon. They made camp early, and dinner was the inadequate New England new kick, parched corn ground to a powder and mixed with hot water, filling but tasteless, and as dark fell, the storm arrived. Lightning cracked without interval, and violent rain doused the fire. While André sat near, Lavinia tried to sleep, but the mad winds tore their lean-to apart. They could hear trees falling in the forest, and could even see them in the stuttering blue flashes. With the shelter gone, they were soaked through in minutes. When lightning cleaved a great pine a short distance away, André wrapped his wet arms around Lavinia as if to take the brunt of any falling tree. 2 hours passed before the rain slackened and suddenly stopped, pushed southeast by an icy wind. André got up, groping in the dark for a log he had set aside earlier, and with his axe laid the interior open. He spent the next half hour with the tinderbox and char cloth, and when that was not successful, put a little gunpowder on the log. The spark ignited. The log surface showed a tiny flame, which he fed with a feather stick and twiglets, then pulled out the dry branches he had cached under their bags. Only then Lavinia remembered the little box of congreves her father had pressed on her before they left. The next morning she dug out the box, opened it, and tried rubbing one of the little strips on a piece of wood, and was utterly surprised when it flared up brilliantly. She held the box out to Andre, who examined the matches, frowned, and handed them back. He preferred steel and spark. And a week later, back in the Detroit house, she learned that matches were dangerous. She was copying out her notes from the trip while Ruby unpacked her bags. She heard a slight noise and a smothered word, then a shriek from the unfortunate maid who had dropped the Congreve's box and stepped on one of the spilled strips, which immediately ignited her cotton dress. Lavinia seized the pitcher in the wash basin and sloshed the contents on the fiery dress, shouted for Mrs. Trame to bring a bucketful, pushed the maid to the floor, and stamped on the still-burning cloth, singeing her own wool skirt hem.
"Butter," said Mrs. Trame. "Butter will calm the pain."
And she ran back down to the kitchen. Ruby's burns on her hands and neck were painful despite the butter. James called in a physician who pooh-poohed the butter and substituted a salve of his own making and prescribed generous doses of opium for the pain. The burns healed, but Ruby's attachment to opium increased, and after several months, James sent the scarred and addicted maid back to Boston with a generous allowance. Lavinia replaced her with a local girl. It was not necessary to go to Ohio to learn scaling. Lavinia swallowed her pride and wrote to Arminius Breitsprecher, explaining what she wanted and asking how to gain the knowledge. Both Breitsprechers were in their Monroe office just back from surveying heavy river sections. Arminius was amused, laughing. He showed the letter to Dieter.
"Duke and Sons, our chief rival.
It seems they may have to change their name to Duke and Daughter, as there are no sons except the young children of Cyrus Hempstead.
James is old, and it looks rather as though this Lavinia, a chit of a girl, will have a position in the company. I think we may quickly swallow them up."
But Dieter thought it must have taken courage to write that letter.
"She has spirit. Does she have brains? Do you know her?"
"I never met her. I just knew she existed. It's lächerlich, a woman wanting to learn how to scale logs. A rich girl's passing fancy. Something she heard about but hasn't any idea of the reasons or procedures."
He crumpled and tossed the letter into the woodbox near the fireplace. It was Dieter who plucked it from the woodbox the next day and answered the letter himself, offering his personal instruction if she could manage to come to Monroe for a week.
"I hope you have some knowledge of mathematics," he wrote. "Few women do, but familiarity with numbers is quite essential in estimating log volumes. I would be pleased to tutor you in the rudiments of the art, and if it is to your liking, you may advance to more difficult problems."
He thought she would not reply. He made the work sound disagreeable and difficult. She wrote back with a list of dates she could be in Monroe and assured him she had no fear of arithmetic nor mathematics, and particularly enjoyed calculus above all things. Not quite the truth.
57. A Cure for Headache. For James, there was one highly annoying disadvantage to living in Detroit. His wine cellar remained in the Boston house, and in Detroit there were rivers of whiskey, but no wine shop. It had always been his intent to have his cellar shipped, but he shuddered when he thought how many good bottles would suffer from stirred-up sediments and take years to settle down. The longer it took to arrange for the packing and shipping, the more he pined for the dark, dusty bottles of choice Madeiras and Clarets in their silent racks. His mouth watered. Dinner without wine was insipid. There was no pleasanter end to a day than a glass of port and a cigar by the fire. James and Lavinia made a point of dining together at each other's table in turn. This night it was James's house. After dinner, venison roast with baked apples, potato souffle, and small business talk, In the library, each with a glass of whiskey, he said, "Lavinia, I am determined to return to Boston and arrange to have my wine crated and shipped here. While I am gone, I will be about 6 weeks away, I am having a carpenter put bottle racks in this cellar. Of course, I shall stay at Black Swan, though likely eat out, visit my tailor and bankers. Where did I put my... There they are." He hung the cord of his pince-nez around his neck. "I've spoken to Cyrus, and he said that while I am away, anything you wish, he will help you procure." Cyrus was becoming hard of hearing, and it meant strenuous shouting to explain anything to him.
"I shall do very well, Papa, and look forward to your return and perhaps a glass of champagne."
"Oh, we will have a champagne gala," said James. "You and I and Cyrus and Clara. I shall bring all the news of Boston with me, as well as wine. If there is anything I may fetch for you, give me a little list. Why not let me choose a new dress for you, something colorful?"
"Books, Papa. I would have some new books. That is all I want."
"And," thought Lavinia, "when you return, I will know how to scale logs." But 2 days before his departure, he came storming to Lavinia's house in a froth. She invited him into the little parlor with the deep green velvet curtains making a dusky, forest-like gloom. The gilt tassels glinted dully. She sat on a chair, ankles crossed. He strode up and down.
"Daughter, I have just made an unpleasant discovery. I am sorry to say this, but that rascal, André Roque, cannot accompany you again on any trips whatsoever."
"May I ask why not?" said Lavinia. "I have always found him to be most accommodating."
"I dare say," sneered James, continuing to stamp across the carpet.
"Oh, do sit down, Papa, sit down. And tell me calmly, what has he done? What is wrong? Why?"
James sat on the edge of a large throne-like chair.
"Why? Never mind. It is not something for a young girl to hear."
She sat straight, both feet flat on the floor, a combative attitude.
"Let me remind you, I am no longer a young girl, but almost a woman grown, and with a masculine mind, as you have several times remarked. I am immune from vapors and fainting. I demand to know why you are forbidding me his company and protection."
Her dark eyes glinted, and the red mouth pressed into a knot. Now he was really irritated.
"Very well. Since you fancy yourself so advanced in worldly experience, I'll tell you that André Roque has got his sister with child. He cannot be trusted with females. Some men are that way."
He thought of his lascivious old father-in-law.
"I do not want him to travel with you again."
He waited for her shocked exclamation. Lavinia said coolly,
"I suppose it comes from all the children sleeping in the same bed."
"How would you know that?"
He was back on his feet.
"I surmise it, that is all."
"A piece of advice, Miss Lavinia. Surmising is the way to greatest error. Never surmise, never."
But what he really feared was that Lavinia might have a streak of Posey's abandoned ways, and the hostler's son would sniff it out and give him an illegitimate grandchild.
"I quite agree that surety is preferable to the most advanced surmising," said Lavinia. "I will do as you say."
And she offered him tea. Back at the old house in Boston, James was struck by its shabby condition. The familiar interior was musty and chill, with an air of fatigue. The furniture, especially the hall stand, seemed cruelly old-fashioned. The rooms looked rather mean. He thought they should not copy every detail in the new house, but simply sell Black Swan as it stood and start anew in Detroit. He would have a talk with the architect while he was in Boston and cancel the copycat plans, present Lavinia with a fait accompli when he returned to the Lake Country. Mr. Prentice, his wine merchant for many years, was excited to see his second-best customer again. His wattled red face contrasted with his pink turkey neck, stretching naked above the new style of low collar and bow tie, and James thought he should have kept to a high stock that would keep him decently covered. The merchant flapped his hands open as though inviting James to dance, and said,
"I am delighted to see you again, Mr. Duke.
Are you returning?
Oh, just a visit.
How may I help you? Would you like to know of the new wines? I have some really good German hock. At your service.